Welcome to Compromising Positions. I'm Leanne Potter, cyber anthropologist and head of security operations for a major retailer.
And I'm Jeff Watkins, a cybersecurity enthusiast and CTO for a major tech consultancy. Together, we're the tech podcast that asks non-cybersecurity professionals what we in the industry can do to make their lives easier.
And help make our organizations more prepared to face ever-changing human-centric cyber threats. In this episode, we're joined by James Hall, developer and founder of Parallax, a digital consultancy that focuses on building better digital experiences together. In this episode, that's illuminating, protecting Aberdeen's IoT streetlights from cyber attacks, James shares his experience on securing public utilities and other IoT devices. He also discusses how he sells security as a value add to his stakeholders, and if bug bounties are actually worth doing.
We love this chat and we think you will do too, so sit back and enjoy our interview with James Hall.
Well, welcome to another episode of Compromising Positions. Today we've got a fantastic guest with us, James Hall, founder and director at Parallax. James, welcome to the show.
Hi, Leanne. Thanks for having me on.
James, I've been watching your career for quite a while. You're good friends with another friend of mine who I really admire, and we also another podcast guest, Josh Nesbitt. But tell our audience a little bit about yourself. So how did you get into tech?
So I've always been interested in technology. My dad was a musician and we always had lots of keyboards and gadgets and things lying around. So I was always tinkering with things. Very interested in BASIC, the programming language that I was using from quite a young age. And then I went to college to do music tech and I thought, I'm not going to be able to make a career out of this. So I only lasted a couple of weeks, although it was good fun. And I ended up working at a company called Bright 5 in York when I was about 15, 16 years old. And they were making software for online training, and also they were doing conferences and live events and things like that. So ended up, yeah, it feels like a past life now, but making like interactive CD-ROMs back when those were a thing.
I remember those. What was your favorite one to work on?
It was Department for Schools and Education was a good one. Yeah, we did a bunch of them, but it was such a different thing because you'd have to have like a hard deadline and then you get a courier to whisk it off on a bike to go get reproduced somewhere. But yeah, it was Macromedia Director, wasn't it? And Flash before Adobe bought them. But
I mean, I one of my most favorite things when I was growing up was Encarta. And when they introduced their dynamic Flash little videos to go with it, I thought it was like the coolest thing ever. I'd spend hours looking through this virtual encyclopedia because the internet was a bit ropey at the time. You know, it was the time when you had to actually know the URL to actually get anywhere. There was no real search engines or anything like that. So I loved stuff like that.
Yeah, if you wanted video, it had to be on CD-ROM. So yeah, we'd do a bit of video production and make interactive stuff, send it out. And then obviously the internet just grew and grew. And I remember like back in the day when I think it was Big Brother and they did their first series and they were like, we're going to stream the Big Brother house live. And you had to pick between Real Media Player, Windows Media Player and QuickTime, didn't you? And you just saw about 50 pixels just smudging around and you tried to squint and make out what was actually going on.
Yeah, I remember when YouTube was very young, and the maximum of 10 minutes, and it was all like 320 pixels, and it was just, yeah, it was bad. But we've come a long way in a very short amount of time, haven't we?
Yeah, that's it.
Yeah, and I guess a lot of the media sort of disappeared along the way with things like CD-ROMs.
Feels like this is turning to an... In my day, you don't know you're born. Yeah. We only had 10 minutes of YouTube. But now it's kind of like the argument, you know, when we used to talk about like, oh, you know, our hi-fis were really big and then they got really small. But YouTube's kind of the same. So like YouTube Shorts and things like that is now the way you consume in just like bite-sized pieces. So all just kind of come round and change and yeah.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah. It's gone full circle, hasn't it? Everyone's attention spans are not...
Well, yeah, I think that's probably why it's responding to that. It's getting shorter. Mm. So tell us more about the company that you founded.
So, yeah, I was at Bright 5 for 7 or 8 years, and then I bumped into Lawrence Dudley. I think it was in a house party. And we got chatting, and we decided that we were going to work together on a project. Lawrence spent a lot of time in the Middle East, so I think the first project was for Kellogg's theme park, which was a Kellogg's-branded sort of Disney knockoff, if you like. And so we developed the website and booking system for that. So we're trying to take money in a country which, yeah, it was quite difficult because like PayPal and things didn't support it at the time.
What does a cereal-based theme park look like? Like, what kind of rides were they advertising on this website?
It didn't look great, but it meant to use assets like Tony the Tiger and stuff. So
nice, yeah.
Yeah, it looked pretty fun. My design skills weren't great. So between me and Loz, we tried to make it look the best we could. But we got a basic e-commerce flow going and some ticket ordering. And we thought, yeah, this kind of works. We should work together. And then we got a really unusual brief through, which was, me and Loz always love tinkering with stuff, but it was to put a huge LED billboard on the M5. And we'd never done anything like that before. So, of course, we said, yeah, absolutely, we'll do that. And we wrote all the software for uploading and scheduling adverts, streaming the video content to the boxes that we put in. But it was absolutely huge, this thing. We weren't involved in actually constructing it, thankfully, because that would have been terrifying. But yeah, we did all the software. And then that's how we got our in with British Airways. We started doing all the airport lounges, Heathrow and business lounges across the world. And yeah, just sort of like, that's how we sort of got onto this, where the real world meets the digital world stuff. And we then met Andy and Dario, who had a company mostly doing web stuff. And we merged forces, and that's how the four of us came together. So this is why you've got this sort of web agency meets software consultancy IoT thing going on with that Parallax has got, which is completely unusual in the market, because we just end up with lots of weird and wonderful things. But that's how we started. I think we met in Vodka Revs in York many moons ago, maybe about 14 years ago.
Nice.
That's one heck of a way to start a company, isn't it? Meeting in Vodka Revolution.
That's it. That's back when we thought that was a cool place to hang out.
So what does a day in life look like for you now?
Very different from when we first started. So I go to bed quite early and wake up really early these days. So yeah, I get up just before 7. I try and do at least 5 minutes or up to 25 minutes of just solid writing. So I use an app called Flow State, which will either terrify you or excite you. It's basically, you have to keep typing or it deletes everything you've written.
Whoa, I've never heard of this. This is nuts.
It's really good. For me, at least, because I get easily excited on like formatting or punctuation and grammar and spelling and stuff. And it just keeps you, it's like almost like having a conversation with someone, but you just keep going. And then it'll be a little bit about maybe what I was dreaming about, a little bit of stuff that I need to do today. And it just helps me get everything out. And then I'll go make a cup of tea. And once you've made something, and that's the first thing you do in the day, you feel like you've won a bit. Cause it's so easy to start the day and just start consuming other people's stuff, like Twitter or what's on LinkedIn and everything else. There's an infinite amount of stuff that we can distract ourselves with. I feel like if you try and flip the day on its head and create something first, you have a much better time. And that sort of sets me up for the day, really. Then I'll head into the office usually, and then I've got my daily stand-ups. So I'm across a number of projects, but I try to keep it into low numbers, ideally 3 or 4. And we'll just do a quick 15 minutes. And it might be that I can help steer it or unblock someone. And then, because of the nature of my job, there is a lot of meetings, unfortunately, but try and get through those as best I can, pack them in. And then ideally I'll have some focus time to write some code still, I'd say.
Oh, that's cool. Like, you still keep hands on.
Yeah. Still keep up to date with how to actually do. I think it's important when you're selling tech to understand how it works. Some of the people on the project teams that are on might not agree that me writing code is a good idea, but I think it's really good. And then, yeah, I'll try to do emails and admin stuff towards the end of the day when my brain stopped working, because that's generally low effort, isn't it?
Aye, it certainly is. So when it comes to Parallax, what's your experience working with security teams? How do you embed them into, well, security concepts into your organization?
Yeah, it's a good question. The general challenge has been early on was that we'd basically develop an app, and then we'd get an external pen testing company to sort of tick a box. And that kind of doesn't work, because you just get this big scary report with a load of stuff that you probably could have found if you'd run a scanner yourself and things like that.
It's an expensive way of doing stuff, isn't it?
It is. And it feels very box ticky. Whereas the work we've been doing recently, we get them engaged much earlier on, which is a lot better. And it means that you can actually make trade-off decisions together, because security is a trade-off between usability or user experience sometimes. So it's just making those right calls and having the right people in the room when you're making those decisions.
And what have you found has been your challenge with engaging with security teams?
I think often it's because of the nature of our projects. They have lots of different elements. Because we're agile, although it's Agile doesn't say no documentation, it's a bit lighter on documentation. I think the challenge is getting what's in our heads out into other people's heads. And I think that's probably true of most organizations. But if anyone can figure out a good way to get people to document stuff, let me know, because it's usually quite challenging.
Use the app, by the sounds of it. Just get it all down quick. Otherwise it's all gone. But I think definitely that communication piece, I've been talking a lot lately. People keep asking me, do you think AI is going to take everyone's jobs? I said no, because for the very reason that we're actually really rubbish at articulating what we want. So we're really rubbish at actually, unless you're one of these prompt engineers that are becoming very popular now and spend a lot of time learning how to ask things in the right way or communicate things in the right way, humans are inherently really bad at getting that thing that's in their head out of their head and communicating in a way that not only they would understand, but other people will be able to understand and digest and understand prioritization. It's just really difficult. So how do you face those kind of communication challenges?
I think the best thing to do is to not assume any prior knowledge. And one of our engineers recommended a while back, what he likes to do is write some documentation or a process or something and then give it to the most junior person in the team and see if they can work through it. And then their feedback is the most important, because they'll probably hit a stumbling block in the first paragraph. And then you go, right, well, that needs fleshing out. But actually walking somebody through your thinking is much better than chucking a document over the fence. Because shared documentation is not the same as shared knowledge. And as much as people would like to write a README once and have done with it, it's not the case. So a lot of pairing, a lot of talking. Three Amigos is another technique. There's a bunch of stuff you can do.
Do you want to explain what the Three Amigos is for our listeners?
Yeah, so Three Amigos is basically a way of having two people have a conversation and one person is a silent listener and they observe. Because that person's not actively communicating in the group, it changes the dynamic of the bits that they pick up on. And they might actually be able to say, well, actually, your conversation's gone off down this path and you've missed all these other things. That's kind of it in a nutshell.
Cool.
You mentioned the term documentation-driven development before. Is that really what you're referring to here?
Yeah. Well, I think in the podcast I was talking around that, it was for library authors. So if you're writing a piece of code that someone else is going to use, it's nice to write the documentation for it first. So this is how you call the API. These are the parameters you pass in. And the reason it's nice to come that way around is because you really think about the experience that they're going to have. Whereas if you start writing some code and then think about it afterwards, you'll start to leak some of your internal implementation detail that you might not want to have.
Yeah.
Or the terminology might not make sense. I think in terms of security, you could do a similar thing by clearly writing the parameters of the security problem that you're trying to address. I think a lot of people, myself included, I'm able to think more clearly by writing down than speaking. And this happens on podcast episodes sometimes, but it's easy to start talking and then you almost fall in love with the first thing that drops out of your mouth. And then that becomes your opinion. Change it. I've listened back to a few old episodes and thought, do I really think that? Or was I just saying it? Just chucking a product over the fence and going, can you please make this secure? I think actually writing out what people's values are, what the expectations are, and what trade-off decisions we might need to make, I think that's going to be really helpful. Mm.
Yes, so the other side of that is what could cybersecurity professionals or a cybersecurity team, if you're working with a client, what could they do to make your life easier?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think more pairing, more working closely together. I've probably got a fairly good handle of where the security problems might be, but what I won't do, because I'm not working exclusively in that day-to-day, I don't know what I don't know. So talking someone through how an app works, hangs together, what the integration areas are, how it works. Like there might be a physical element or a barrier or an LED screen and things like that. There's a load of potential risks that I might not even have thought of. So just chatting through that with someone. Ideally, I know I've said a lot about writing stuff down, but actually face-to-face is really good for that, because you get that sort of free-flowing exchange, don't you?
Yeah, you mentioned there, just actually, because you mentioned you've got some actually IoT, you do a mixture of IoT and web work. So I've not got a lot of experience in IoT personally. But what I've heard about is obviously a lot of things about the variety of different protocols and how quite a lot of things maybe aren't as secure as you'd hope. I think a lot of CCTV systems that are given as an example. I mean, how different is the security, the security aspect in IoT?
The good thing for us is that the landscape is so poor, it's kind of quite easy to be good. It tends to be hardware manufacturers that have then decided that they need to write some software.
I love that. Leveraging a nice low bar.
Yeah, that's it. You can just easily stick your head and shoulders above the rest a little bit. Yeah, the hardware manufacturers really have no idea how to write software. And they don't have any interest in making it secure because it makes it more difficult to use. Yeah, for example, a lot of these smart meters, the manufacturers early on decided, oh, we'll just have a single key for every meter that we ever put out. And actually, Zigbee, the protocol that they used, is quite insecure as well. So this caused a huge problem. They can't just patch it because they can't do over-the-air firmware updates. So you have to wait 10 years for these things to be replaced. So it's really bad. So when we designed the street lighting system that's used in Aberdeen, we started from the principle of, well, what's the opposite of everything having a shared key, and that is every light has its own individual key. So that's what we did. Every street light in Aberdeen has got its own cryptographic key pair. And then in order to do an OTA, we have to talk to each street light individually and then communicate a new shared key to talk to them all at the same time. And then we can do what's called a multicast firmware update. It's super secure, and we do that over radio. So we send out lots of 50 byte packets, but we had to make a load of different decisions around how to do that in a secure way.
So that's sounds like a really cool project. And obviously Jeff and I work in one in security, and Jeff being a security enthusiast can kind of follow that thread. How do you sell this to the client? Because obviously that adds a little bit of extra complexity to things. And they're just like, do they turn around and just go, well, it's a street light. What are you actually protecting against here?
Yeah, I mean, it's tricky. There's lots of stakeholders. So for that particular product, it's councils, and the hardware manufacturer is involved in the design process as well. It was kind of an easy sell because we just explained what the risks could be. Also, there's risks in network design. One of my favorite stories in IoT failures is a company called PetNet, and they had a device where you could basically put a schedule on your phone and it feeds your cat or whatever pet at different intervals. They had a massive server outage, and actually that stopped working because instead of storing the schedule on the device, which is the sensible route, they stored the schedule in the cloud and then just ping the device when it needs to feed. So your Wi-Fi needs to be up, the cloud needs to be working, but it basically feels like the wind needs to be blowing in the right direction for your pet to get fed. And on Twitter, everyone was kicking off saying, like, starve your cat as a service and all this. So we used that as an example of what not to do. And then we were like, well, clearly the schedule for the lights needs to be on the device, like on the light itself. It can't be at the gateway, which is one level up, or God forbid, on the internet level. Mm-hmm. You wouldn't want the headline. We like to do like a headline, which is a good PR news story, and then like a disaster news story, like mock BBC homepage, like Aberdeen plunges into darkness because of internet outage or something.
Do you actually put that into your slide deck when you're presenting or something like that?
Yeah, it's good to frame it like
that's
that.
That's really cool. That's a really great use of storytelling to really convey that message. I like that a lot.
People don't think about risks on the risk register in as real things that could happen until you frame it as a news report or a PR piece or something.
I'm going to nick that idea. I normally do things like that for tabletop exercises, you know, so we'll run through a scenario, then all of a sudden a news story will pop up and that'll be it. And that works really effectively. But actually to put that as a slide deck before you're doing a simulation or anything like that, and actually those initial conversations about risk, I love that. That's such a great idea.
Yeah, bringing risk to life is really important because otherwise people will deprioritize it. But yeah, it's a cool project, and we've taken our learnings from that and applied it to like the ice baths that we're producing and working on like car parking entry systems and things like that. So you need to think about all your failure modes and how it could go wrong.
Yeah, definitely. So I do listen to your podcast. Off Script is the title, am I correct? I've got that right, haven't I?
Thanks for the
yeah you get another opportunity at the end to plug. And I was remember one episode I was listening to, and you said on your show, the tech can't be decided by those who know the least about tech, and that was in relation to EU cookie law. And I think this raises a really interesting point about expertise, and it also, the other flip side of it, does the tech industry have too much power as well? Put this in a security context, the security can't be decided by those who know the least about security, in my opinion.
Yeah.
And I think that is probably quite a lot of security teams. And this is not a slight on security teams. This is more to say that as security professionals, we need to know a lot about a lot of things. And there's no way on earth we could be a specialist in it unless you really take that time and say, I am a specialist in this. But to be honest, there's very few jobs in security where you're allowed to focus on one thing. Coming back to your point, you know, the tech can't be decided by those who know the least about tech. Is that the same for security, do you think?
I do. I think it's easy to have the right intention, which the EU cookie law definitely did. but it was just the implementation. They let each country decide how they're going to attack the problem. And a lot of countries don't have a lot of time to think about it. So they will basically take the law and then go, it's up to each individual website author to implement this, which is what they all did. And then you get a million and one different ways of opting in or out to various things, when actually, if you'd have given that law or problem to Google, I'm not saying it's a good idea, but Google engineers are highly skilled, they've got a lot more time to think about this, they would have probably thought, this needs to be a setting in Chrome and we'll send a header and that will change the way cookies behave on a website. It's not that the EU had a bad idea, it's that they couldn't think about how the tech could be applied. And then I guess some of the thinking around that ended up becoming the do not track specification, which got first implemented in Firefox. But that's really what this cookie law should have been from the start. In terms of security teams, yeah, it's not for people that don't understand the security to make the trade-off decision, because they probably don't have enough information to know if they're making the right call or not.
I mean, there are probably some hard lines, but it really is up to the business, isn't it, it should be up to the business within the sort of ethical and legal boundaries to draw where their risk appetite is, where their risk posture wants to be, because they might want to be slightly riskier, have things slightly more available and slightly more usable.
Yeah, that's it. Different products have different risk appetite. If you're making a bot that gives you football facts, it's very different from something that tells you about the best way to tackle a conflict of interest in the mining industry. They're two different polar opposites. So yeah, it's a decision to be made, isn't it?
In engineering, simplicity is often the best kind of solution. Although I think when people build software or when people start architecting software, I think the first tendency is to try and overcomplicate things. And over time, I've certainly learned to appreciate simplicity more. From a security point of view, what kind of things would you like to see simplified? I guess from your point of view, but also maybe from like also as a user of security's point of view.
Yeah, for me, I spent a lot of time battling with AWS's identity and access management. And other cloud providers have got similar solutions. What happens is junior devs will get frustrated and then they'll open the floodgates and give full access to everything within an AWS account because they don't know how to make the tech work. Amazon have made some good steps to simplify this. There is a good trick where you can make a sandbox account. You can run the code as you were going to run it, and it actually generates the policy from the activity log. So a junior dev could just write the code they want to write, run it the way they want to run it, see what it actually calls, and then press a button and they get a nice lockdown policy that just locks it down to those specific actions that it did. Nice UIs and interfaces that allow that to happen to make people make good decisions without much effort, I think that's the way forward.
So I've seen this before when they talk about planning pathways and things in physical architecture and design, is often they'd put grass down and then find where the worn grass was and say, okay, that looks like that's where we should put the paths. And yeah, maybe with the some kind of equivalent for security, obviously you've got to spot the outliers. You don't want to actually have a legitimate security route in for people who are trying to hack your system.
Yeah, it's like desire lines. Yeah, and actually using that to dictate the architecture or the pathways that you put in. I think that makes total sense to me.
So the next question I had for you is, I've been thinking a lot about, both in my own life, but also in work, about how bad we are estimating how long something's going to take, particularly when it comes to things like editing this podcast, for example. Like, oh, it won't take very long. And it just ends up taking hours and hours and hours. We appreciate that. So thank you for being a guest on the show. But because humans are so terrible at estimating how long a project's going to take, and I think security are a big component of that, because obviously you need to factor in time to, one, find these things. Either, hopefully you do it in a shift left approach. Really hate that term, it's a nice shorthand. And a shift left approach where, you know, maybe you're scanning your code in the IDE as you're writing, using tools like Sneak, for example, or you've got quality gates within your CI/CD pipeline, and that will kind of stop you from pushing anything malicious out into the production environment. Or, you know, like you say, maybe you've done a pen test and you need time to factor in there's going to be a remediation process in there. With all that being said, for you in your world, how would me as a security person best enable you to estimate how long some of these security fixes are going to take, so that you can put it onto your backlog, and so it's not a hard stop just before you're going to go live with security saying, nope, you can't go live, you've not fixed this yet, and I don't know how long it's going to take you to fix this stuff?
Yeah, I mean, humans are awful at estimating, but what they are quite good is deciding the relative sides compared to something else. If the task has enough detail to hint towards a rough idea of implementation, and it's small enough that it's not conflating lots of different things together, you'll often find even a junior dev might be able to say, well, changing all the headers on this part of the application is probably going to take roughly the same time as this task did over here, or it's a little bit bigger. So we use the Fibonacci sequence and we story point. If a security researcher can give us a single line, which is a good summary, and that's a good ticket title, and then with a little bit of detail of what the expected output is when you test it, maybe a little bit of technical elaboration of what the fix might be, that would be enough to give a relative size. Might need to flesh it out a little bit more before they immediately add it to the current sprint. But yeah, I think that would be enough.
Every single place I've been, can we build an estimation framework? Well, the answer is yes, you can. Build a framework that will give you some heuristics, but don't expect it to magically give you numbers you can fix price anything on, or at least not usefully. At least not a usefully small number. You know, I'm sure we could fix price most projects at £1 billion. It's just nobody's going to go for it. I guess one of the other things that's quite prevalent in the security community right now is bug bounties and people finding, I guess, apropos nothing, going and finding problems in your systems and then going, well, I'd quite like a payment for finding that. What is your opinion on that? I guess bug bounties themselves, but also the people who kind of go and bug bounty hunting.
I think it's great. I think especially for younger, less experienced tinkerers, let's call them, that are maybe finding or coming across these things, they might be tempted to do something not good with that information just because they're early in their careers or whatever it is. Bug bounties, back in the day, I think it was Facebook were doing like some of the more early, bigger bounties for things. And it was because people were finding stuff and, yeah, finding ways to cause odd results in Facebook itself. And what tends to happen with security researchers is they'll find this massive problem and they've spent a load of time detailing it and unpicking it. And to get rewarded for their time, it almost feels like extortion. They come to the company and go, look, I found this huge problem. I've spent a load of time and I could spend a load more time telling you what it is, but can you give me some money? And to the company, that feels like, this guy is holding us to ransom, or girl, and they know something about our system and they're not telling us. Well, actually, they're just trying to get fair value for the work and effort that they've put in and are about to put in, because as we've discussed before, communicating and sharing knowledge actually takes time and is difficult. I think a bug bounty avoids that sort of extortion feeling interaction happening. So they can just go and say, yeah, they'll have a set process for the requirements that the bug bounty needs to meet, like responsible disclosure. You shouldn't be posting in IRC or Reddit about what you found before you've responsibly disclosed it, things like that. All these good security responsible disclosure practices are baked into the bug bounty program, and then they learn about how that works from early on in their career, and then they might be able to carry on and make a living out of that if that's what they want to do. So yeah, long way of saying I think it's a good idea, really.
I think companies are proactively having a bug bounty program and sort of terms of engagement probably does make them feel a little bit less attacked, as you said. I think companies who don't ever participate in that, it's like a code review, only the code review is from a mugger.
Yeah. Yeah,
which isn't a pleasant feeling. It's an uncomfortable feeling.
I mean, I used to find a bunch of SQL injection and cross-site scripting flaws and things. I did find one in the BBC News website once, and I just used it to make silly articles with my mates in, but it's not really, because it's just cross-site scripting on a public page. It's not a massive problem, but yeah, the SQL injection stuff, you do want people to know about. Thankfully, those more basic flaws are now much less prevalent in the web, but yeah, it means that there's a lot of bigger things lurking out there that are more difficult to unpick.
Yeah, and I think that the key with anyone thinking about undertaking a bug bounty program is to really put those boundaries in place as well, and really be specific about what tools can and can't be used. You know, you don't want anyone to DDoS your site to prove a point. That's not really ideal. Like, thanks for that. But I think I've been lucky enough to run a bug bounty program before. I think the key thing for me is you really do need someone to manage those communications, because they can get quite testy very quickly. And for the points you outline earlier, you know, people are doing this either for money, to learn, for kudos and things like that. And so they do expect when they find something to kind of get a response very, very quickly. And if you do set up a bug bounty and don't have someone in place who's there to actually manage those correspondence, you're going to be in a world of pain, I think. And I think it's really key to keep people on side, keep up that goodwill for sure, because a really pleasant bug bounty program can turn a bit sour very quickly.
Yeah, definitely. Because you've got people hunting for problems, not getting a response, and then publishing those. So yeah, it could backfire, couldn't it?
Absolutely. So here's a scenario for you. You get a pen test report delivered to your door after you've asked for it. What are your first thoughts about the way that that information is presented to you? And could we, as a security function, be presenting that information to you better?
So if it's just dumped through the letterbox like a big yellow pages or something, probably quite exciting juicing, isn't it? It feels like you're waiting for results from a doctor and you don't know what's in there. Say, yeah, big old report. I think a lot of people are moving away from that delivery mechanism. It's probably more collaborative would be nicer. I guess just more talking through things rather than a big let's just chuck it over the fence report. That suits the way I'd like to work better. But I don't know what your thoughts and how do people usually ask people you to interact with their teams?
I think that wash up, like getting people in a room together and saying, okay, so this is the findings. I would hope that the security team would first go through the findings and make an assessment on behalf of the engineering team and say, actually, these are the ones we really care about. You know, I'd really like you to prioritize these, and these are the reasons why. But have that dialogue, because I have seen it in the past where security teams, you know, get a pen test report and it's like, you need to fix this. And then that's it. And then just like the, you know, the hand on the desk. Desk, no indication of where should we focus on, how long have we got, or wait a minute, got to deliver this in 3 weeks' time. This looks like there's a lot of work here. How would we even tackle this? And how also do you want us to fix it? Like some of the stuff that comes out in a pen test is unfixable. And so what the mitigations. Now, a nice quick, oh, you just need to update a library. Brilliant. That's a very low-hanging fruit, hopefully. Sometimes it's not, but mostly it's a low-hanging fruit. But things where there's no fixes, but maybe you need to do a bit of wizardry in terms of, okay, let's hide this from the code base and move these things around and things like that. That might have a bigger impact. I think there could be more to do there in terms of that collaboration piece.
Yeah, I think it needs to be people talking to each other and figuring out those trade-off decisions. Yeah, you're right. And some security problems are unfixable. Maybe it's something that started right in the design of the product early on.
I think there's another really important one for pen test stuff as well. And I don't think when pen test reports, they talk about the priority, the severity of it all, but quite often they don't say, oh, it's difficult unless you're quite technical to actually gather, could this lead to effectively a widening of the attack? Could this lead to them actually gaining ingress into other things? So for example, recently heard about there's an exploit in a particular library that's like, well, it was on one particular server that was used for non-sensitive data. So you go, happy days, that's not that high priority. Oh, but that allows you to give you arbitrary code execution, which means you can get on as root. Is that system was part of a network? Does that then allow you to spread that attack elsewhere? And I think the reports I've seen haven't necessarily been very good at saying, well, okay, this very minor system might be affected, but the point is it actually could affect your entire estate. And I think that's a real problem, because people go, oh, it's all right, that's the coffee machine's web server, that's fine, we don't need to fix that. But it means they could get access to your account system.
Yeah, 100%. Like, what's the blast radius or potential blast radius?
And it's same with CVS scores, isn't it? CVSS scores, without any context, they can look dire. You can get a 9.8, but then you actually do that due diligence and actually, no, it doesn't affect us at all. So where's the fire? Where's the issue? And I think, Jeff, we saw a talk, didn't we, recently for the Yorkshire Cyber Conference. And I think it was Precursor, the Pentest company. And they have a thing where they rate all, you know, obviously come out with all the vulnerabilities, but then they do a second pass through where they go, okay, so what of this stuff is actually got any fixes? If it has a fix, yes or no, then it gets ranked again. And then there was another column where it gets ranked again in terms of, now, is this actually exploitable in the wild? Are people actually using this? And it turned out that actually there was quite a lot more medium to low vulnerabilities that were the bigger issue than the high. And sometimes you can forget about that as well.
That was a real eye-opener, that, because the prioritization was based on, it was basically given a prioritization that is almost unhelpful, because people were spending time fixing stuff that was so exotic that it was probably not a lot of help to fix it, whereas actually they were leaving the gates wide open on other things in this sort of example report, which I think was, oh, I'd never really thought of it like that. Because prioritization is obviously really super important for everything we do, because like a lot of technical debt, I mean, this is just technical debt, except that it's like from a payday loan company and they're going to come around with knuckle dusters and break your nose. It's one of those technical debts that unfortunately has real fangs, and getting the prioritization wrong, like, oh, that's kind of spicy.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, Precursor are a really good outfit, and they can really present stuff in a way that makes a lot of sense. And yeah, I think I love the way that they approach stuff.
Yeah, they are very good. They'd like to sponsor the show. That's entirely up to them. But it was a good play, because, you know, as humans, we are trained to go on a report, and you know, a lot of reports do this very well. Red is bad. But as that talk that Precursor did showed, yeah, the mediums and lows, it's because we've got our eye off the ball. That's what attackers, you know, are also going for. And you hear of so many stories of people leveraging just the most basic of things. You think, oh, that was just seemed too easy.
Yeah, definitely.
So I think, Jeff, you have a final question about AI.
You've been quite a thought leader as of late on AI. In a pre-show discussion, you talked about the EU AI Act and had some interesting thoughts about the impact on the tech industry. I guess, and I mean, obviously, the UK's version of it is quite different. It's quite two sides of permissive versus quite restrictive. And I guess, do you think the EU AI Act is going to encourage or stifle innovation in the tech industry?
That's a good question. I think it will do a little bit of both, because I think for really, really small organisations that find meeting regulations quite difficult, I think that's going to, it might add a little bit of friction, but it is quite a well-balanced sort of forward-looking piece of legislation. And it focuses on ethics and outcomes rather than specific techniques. And I think even though the initial draft was done well before ChatGPT came out, it does hold up pretty well. I think it's going to help teams think about the kind of problems that they need to be aware of. We're using it as, we basically treat all the applications we're doing as high risk, even though they're not. So we'll just follow the techniques and principles outlined in the law, regardless of the risk level, because I think it's this good stuff to do anyway. And Oxford University have published an amazing report called CAP AI, and it's basically a method of measurable application of the law. So ethics is quite fuzzy and quite difficult to quantify, so it makes it scorable in a way, but it's definitely worth checking out. So I think it might be a case of, like, you know, sometimes you have to slow down to go faster. It might be a bit of that, where people might need to just pop the brakes on a little bit, check out what the regulations are, figure out how they're going to apply it, and yeah, I think then eventually that'll speed you up. You've got your ethical framework, you've done your internal values session, and so we did a session the other week where some of the new projects coming through the door, we scored a load of different scenarios from 0 to 10, like strongly disagree to strongly agree. And it's things like, an AI should be able to decide a management action plan for bribery in this country or whatever, and everyone says obviously not, that's zero. But then it's interesting when it all falls in the middle, or you get a spread of people going across 0 to 10, and that sparks the really interesting conversations where you can put a load of post-it notes on the wall and go, well, I said 3 because this outcome might happen, or I said 7 because I didn't even think about some of the risks. So just going through the law and the risks and getting it all out in the open and getting people to agree on what they think good looks like is actually a really useful exercise.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. I think there's a load of different interesting scorings you can do with AI, even just around the opportunities as well. Like, how suitable is something for automation currently? Because there's some stuff in the physical world where it's going to be pretty tricky. But I guess the other thing about this is, though, and I remember when Elon Musk first said, obviously after having left OpenAI, saying, oh, we should slow this down, we should stop. And then the next day going out and buying $400 million worth of GPUs. Like, sir, either you're going to be playing a lot of Minecraft, or you are not sticking to your end of the bargain here. I guess the problem is with regulation is if we slow down, other countries and other less friendly nation states may not. And therein lies the rub. And especially when we start thinking about AI as being a threat and also a sword and a shield.
Yeah, that's a very good point. I don't have a good answer for that, but I do think we have to play by some good rules. But yeah, other countries and actors might not be as friendly.
Yeah, I don't think there is a good answer, frankly. I think it's interesting. I mean, I think maybe the closest thing I have to, a wide wish on this is that even if we slow down AI for consumer uses, we should not slow down AI research or AI for countermeasures, because those feel kind of important. Because if we get absolutely swamped with automated cyber weapons of mass destruction, we absolutely need a shield to their sword.
Yeah, definitely.
Well, this has been a really interesting discussion. Thank you so much, James, for sharing your thoughts about security. I know we could probably talk all day about it. I know you've also done podcasts yourself, so I will link those in the show notes to your security-related ones for our listeners, because I'm sure they'll find it very interesting. But, James, where can they find you if they want to get hold of you?
So the website is Parallax.ax. We also got parallax.co.uk, because that's really difficult to read out. And also Offscript is the name of the podcast, and that's Hey Presents. But yeah, we'll stick the links in the show notes.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much for your time. It's been a blast.
Thank you.
Cheers, Leanne. Cheers, Jeff.
Wow, what a great chat. I mean, I found his example about the Aberdeen streetlights really fascinating.
Yeah, examples like that are really great to hear. But I think it's even more great to hear people like James being proper security champions. I get the impression for James that security isn't just a nice to have. It always comes first in his development process, and it's really quite refreshing to hear.
Yeah, but it really did make me look twice at my smart meter.
Yeah, I know, right? We are utterly surrounded by IoT devices wherever we go, and it's not exactly comforting to know how vulnerable they are.
But that's why I also love what he was saying about the way he sells the importance of security, right down to including a slide in his deck on the absolute disaster of not doing security. That's certainly something that might be popping into my slide decks going forward.
Oh, me too. Right, I'm going to go off down a rabbit hole now to look at the Zigbee protocol. Tinfoil hats a go-go.
Enjoy. Links to everything James discussed in this episode can be found on the show notes. And if you like the show, please do leave us a review and share on LinkedIn or in your teams. It really helps spread the word and get high-quality guests like James on in future episodes.
We hope you enjoyed this episode. See you next time. Keep secure, and don't forget to ask yourself, am I the compromising position here?